Hello, and welcome to the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I'm your host, Willem Vanderhorst. It's already a fourth episode, and for this one, I'm joined by another Vanderhorst, my brother Bjorn, and his business partner, Omar Romero. I, on the family side, just to mention, I have three siblings. Both my brothers are chefs, and my sister is a winemaker in the south of France. So I eat both their food, I drink her wine, and I guess I talk about it. I brew beer on the side, but that's more of a hobby, and I haven't done it in a little while, actually. I'd like to start again, but we'll talk about that some other time. So yeah, you can imagine the family reunions are pretty, they're a lot of fun. They're really good fun. It's always a pleasure to see my brothers, and I love hanging out with them, and my sister as well. Both Bjorn and Omar talk about their careers in the episode, so I'm not going to give away too much right now. I'll just say they're acclaimed and awarded chefs. In a nutshell, Bjorn originally trained with Alain Ducasse in Paris. He's worked in the United States for a long time. He's owned his own restaurants. He's won Michelin stars in London for two different restaurants. He moved on to being the exec chef and managing food and beverage for luxury resorts and hotels. So that's just for the short one. Omar's worked in France. He was trained in Mexico. He's from Mexico in the first place, actually. He's worked in New York. He's worked in the UK with chefs such as Gary Rhodes and Gordon Ramsay. He was actually the first Mexican-born chef to hold a Michelin star in Europe. Now, they've created their own business together, consulting with restaurant groups as well as creating new food and beverage concepts. They have several very exciting projects they talk about in the episode, including the Bone Tea Broth Bar. On that point, talking about Bone Tea, they talk about an upcoming crowdfunding project that they were planning to launch on Crowdcube. They were almost ready. They had all their material and the video and everything else. But since we recorded, things have changed. They ended up taking the route of private investment for the next steps of the project. So stay tuned for more news on the Bone Tea Broth Bar and hopefully Bone Tea Broth Bar opening very soon near you. As usual, links to all the different information is going to be in the show notes. So without further ado, here are Bjorn and Omar. Okay, Bjorn and Omar, thank you for joining me for the show. It's just to describe, because the scene is quite cool, even though it's a little bit grayed out in London today. Do you want to say, like, describe where we are? We can talk about it, right?
Yeah, we're up in the sky.
Yes.
Kind of. It's not grayed out, it's gray. G-R-E-Y.
Which is quite normal in London. Yeah. But
today's particularly gray. Like, we really can't... on a good day from here, we can see the entire skyline of London from Canary Wharf, if you're familiar with the city, all the way to, well past Chelsea Harbour. So yeah. That entire distance there. So all the big landmarks and monuments, and Big Ben and Westminster Abbey and the BT Tower and all the buildings, the Gherkin and the Shard.
And Winter Wonderland now, which is very colorful. Yes.
There's Winter Wonderland, the fair in Hyde Park. So we're on the 23rd floor of the London Hilton Metropole.
Yep.
Yeah, that's it.
And that you're going to be taking over and you're building a brand new restaurant in.
Correct. Yeah, yes. Right now it's sort of an empty, barren space, but we're attacking the space within the next few days.
We're bringing the fun to this side of the city. I think it's in need of desperate need of something funny around here.
Bringing the fun. It's the we're bringing East London to the West.
Okay, cool. So I start usually these interviews with a couple of warm up questions. So you get one each on something unrelated to the rest of what we're going to be talking about, but that I've noted. Omar, I don't really know you very well, but I know that you've done a happening at Carousel, and I believe that you grew up with Japanese anime. You're still quite into your manga and anime, or mostly anime?
Yeah, well, manga and anime, but mostly anime, I will say. But I mean, I love it.
Did you have a favorite series growing up?
Yeah, well, that was how is it called? Senseiya, which is Caballeros del Zodiaco, because I'm Mexican, so that's how it was. Yeah, but I mean, everything from the old Godzilla movies from the 60s that are just so weird and dark, and the Godzilla doesn't even represent a Godzilla. It's just like a lizard in some weird shape. But since then, I loved it. From the 60s, I mean, the 60s was big movement of that, bringing all the, like, Ultraman and just big superheroes from Japan and make them a bit westernized,
yeah,
which was actually quite fun. Yeah, until now, I mean, I love it. I enjoy my hyper Japan when it happens here, and the whole craziness about it, and I love K-pop and J-pop and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's
awesome. Freak. We'll talk about that, Bjorn. You know that I also interview game designers on the show, and I like my tabletop games. And I remember, well, obviously, we're brothers, and I'll talk about that in the intro that I'll record separately. But I remember you telling me, like, when we were growing up in the States, you used to play Dungeons and Dragons when you were a kid.
Yes.
Do you have any, like, do you remember something about it or an anecdote that you can talk about?
I played, amongst many various characters that I had, but I had a favorite character. I mean, remember, I was playing this, must have been, God, maybe I started when I was 9 years old and played till I was probably about 11 or 12, sort of dwindling down to once every couple of months towards the end. But, and we had a dungeon master that was, God, he seemed so old, but he couldn't have been more than 17, I imagine, or 16. He had a little bit of fuzz on his face. But he was scary. Yeah, it had a character, he was a paladin, which I got really attached to. Chaotic good, and then something happened to him and he became chaotic evil. Anyway, these are the things I remember from Dungeons and Dragons playing. But it was a cool thing to do. I think it was super in fashion, right? So like every kid was doing
it. It was the big time for it, early 80s, right?
Massive, yeah. Huge time for it. I think they were also coming out with some pretty whacked out arcade games that cost more than the other ones because the graphics were better and all of that. So you had your classic Pac-Man and Donkey Kong, but then they were coming out with these sort of more Dungeons and Dragons type games where you ran around with a sword, sort of like one person shooter but with a sword. And that was really cool. But yeah, it was a big thing. It was a thing that boys did. I mean, girls weren't involved so much at the time. Not in my group, anyway. But it was a thing that was, it was super big. People had the dice and all the books and all this other stuff. And it was a good way to stay indoors. Growing up in New York, it was 3 or 4 months of the year where it's kind of cold, right? There's a lot of snow. So you kind of hide out indoors. Probably played a lot less during the summer.
Yeah. Cool. Great. Okay. So you're both chefs.
Yeah.
Do you want to give us a bit of a roundup quickly of your, like, how you got into it or how you started cooking or, like, you decided to start doing it professionally?
Well, sure. I always like cooking. One of my first gifts to my mom was to cook something for her or just buy a fake cake and then just decorate it myself. And
how old were you then?
About 5, probably.
Cool.
I used to play with my best friends, I opened a restaurant actually, and I just to make a, I couldn't cook properly in the oven, so the most I could do was like omelette, so I did a flat omelette and make it look like a pizza and then pretend that I was selling pizza to my friends. So I always liked to cook, but actually I was very deep into archaeology. I mean, growing up in Mexico, it's a deep part in my culture. It's very important. And I love all that culture behind us and our roots. So I love history and I was super interested in archaeology and with lots of sites in Mexico with just pyramids being found each year and there's more to see. I just wanted to do that, but I'm also ambitious and entrepreneurial, I would say. Since I'm a kid, I used to sell candies and stuff like that. I got my first job at 16 on a bar because my mom said, if you want your car, then you need to put some money in. So I just actually got a fake ID and start working at 16 on a bar at night, all the weekends. And I started liking the hospitality and serving people and the whole thing. But I realized that I really like to cook, and that's something that actually my mom doesn't cook that much. My dad does.
Mm-hmm.
And basically watching my dad and my nanny, which was Juanita, which came from Oaxaca, which is one of the best states where you can learn food from. And my grandmother, she was a great cook. I mean, I think everybody thinks your grandmother is the best cook ever. But mine was. So that's when I kind of started. That's when I kind of liked cooking, but never saw it as a profession until just to start doing some research And obviously, well, a restaurant is also, it's also a good business if you know how to run it. So I just wanted to learn the whole thing. So that's why I, instead of studying gastronomy or being a chef or all that, I wanted to get into restaurant management. So I did. I got a degree in restaurant management. And then I said, well, yeah, what I like is to cook. So I want to specialize in food. So, yeah, I went briefly to Las Vegas to work in a Mexican restaurant. And then with that money I earned after university, then I went to the Culinary Institute of America for a while. Then I came back to Mexico, but then I just thought I needed to expand my horizons. So I saved money to go to France. So I arrived in Paris thinking that I could speak French, but in reality and with the Parisians not being that friendly if you don't speak French, then I realized I didn't. And so I started studying French, and I studied some more cuisine in the hotel Ritz.
Is that one moment you were kind of decided to go towards fine dining at that point, or?
I think since New York, I kind of wanted to go to do fine dining.
Okay.
And being in the culinary and looking at all these people, and I got great teachers. I got a Robert von Bernardin showing us how to do lobster and all fish and just how the way he treated fish and the way he talked about it. It was just so passionate that I said, yeah, I want to do this. Mm-hmm. But at that level. So that's when going back to Mexico and already running a brasserie, then I said, well, no, I kind of want to see more. So yeah, I went to Paris. I studied French and French as a language and French cuisine, and then I just desperately looked for a job, which is not easy being Mexican and getting the visa and all that. I probably have sent 800 CVs, honestly, until some people called me but said, well, yeah, no, you don't have a visa. So still ruled by the Franks at the time. There was no mm-hmm. Europe. There was no European community. But yeah, I found a place in Evian, which nobody wanted to go, but it was actually really good and really luxurious, and it was a nice place. So they decided to hire me there and made my visa. So
for the people who don't know, that's in the Alps, right? In the mountains.
Yeah, that's in the Alps. That's in
where the water comes from.
Yeah, exactly, obviously. Where the water comes from.
Yeah.
And just in front of Lac Léman.
That's where water comes from.
Yeah, well, that's
the original place.
Yeah, but you say Evian, nobody really knows. You always have to say, yeah, Evian, where the water comes from. So then you're like, oh,
that's
yeah.
That's your accent.
Well, I can say it in French, though. No, but and it was great. It was good. It was good to learn how French do food. And it's completely different to what American does.
Mm.
I think in America, it's a business, and it's about profit, and it's about doing it well, but because it's a business. And doing it in France is just more passion and more of a trade.
Mm.
So I love that side. I stayed there for 2 years. Then wanted to stay longer. I couldn't. So I did a trip to Bordeaux and lived briefly in Bordeaux and do the vineyards and the whole thing. As I didn't grow up with wine, I grew up with tequila and beer.
Yeah.
But I learned, and I learned to like it, and I learned to pair it and to understand it. And on start the process. So I was lucky that I met someone that recommended me to a French chef here in England who was about to open a restaurant in Surrey. So I moved down here. He wanted someone that speak French. At the time I could speak French, so who speaks probably French and English. So so it was me. So I stayed here and I worked with that company for about 2-3 years in Surrey. And then I just wanted to go back again to fine dining. So I just moved down to London, and I was lucky enough to secure a place in Ramsay's, Three Michelin Star. So I worked there, stayed a bit longer than a year. And then I started working for another big chef here in England, which was a guy Rhodes. At the time, he was very big. And I stayed there with him for 5 years. I decided to leave. Then he said, well, don't leave, so let's go to Dubai. I'm going to open something in Dubai. I went to Dubai for 2 years. And then I came back because he wanted me to run the Michelin star, which I did. And I was lucky enough to keep the star until the guide of 2013, which made me the first Mexican in Europe to hold the Michelin star.
Wow.
Then I... I went to Abu Dhabi briefly to do the opening of St. Regis Abu Dhabi. And at that time, I got a call from Bjorn saying, well, you seem interesting. So why don't you join us to the opening of Rosewood? So I see him. I knew him before because during my time here, I was doing stages here and there in London, and I did one with him. Mm. And I remember very much that he got baby eels and he was super excited about it. And the whole talk about the baby eels and how we're going to cook them, and I was just playing with him for a while, and it was good. I mean, me being just an estager who he could ignore me because a lot of chefs do.
Yeah.
Now he was taking me and embracing me and then just explaining me, and we were having fun and it was good. So I just remember that. So I said, yeah, this is a good guy that I could work with. And it did happen through our time in Rosewood. We just saw that we share some more similar values. And although we came from different backgrounds and we have different opinions, I think our main goal remains the same, and mm-hmm. our way of seeing life is very similar. So yeah, this is what brought us to here, to creating a slow group, which is our hospitality group, which we want to create something different for the industry.
Yeah. All right, cool. We'll come back to slow group and talk about it, but I guess like we'll hand over to Bjorn. And well, how did you cook the baby eels? Do you remember?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
No. Ceviche style, man. We sent them out moving.
Yeah. Okay, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, he tried to send them to the pan, and he's like, no, this is wrong. And they get dark. No, well, and he's like, no. Just scratching his head as he does when he thinks about something. And then he just started playing it, and no, let's send it like that. And everybody, like, in the kitchen just shut up. Like, yeah, let's send them like that. Let's do it. Get some dressings, and then get some things like that, cover it, send it. And we did. It was good.
Where was that?
At the greenhouse.
At the greenhouse. Cool.
Yeah. I remember it was in a very lovely coupe plate with a little push.
Yeah.
To the surprise of the diner, the little eels were still moving. Dying slowly because of the acidity of the vinaigrette or whatever it was. So be it.
Did you taste it?
Sent them off to a slow death. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we all ate quite a few.
Yeah. I think we ate probably half of them.
More than we should have, because they're super expensive.
Yeah.
Bjorn, do you want to give us a bit of a overview? I mean, I don't know if you want to... Where did you start?
I don't have that romantic story of realizing things so early on. I think I was never that smart, so I kind of didn't realize much till much later on in life, but... When I was 16, I ended up working in I had this experience where I worked in a restaurant not very far away from where our parents were living, sort of side road steakhouse called Chez Firmin.
Outside Paris, that is, right?
Yeah, outside Paris on a national road, one of these sort of chain steakhouse places that you find, Courtebaille and stuff like that. Chez Firmin. The emblem was, Firmin Point was a very famous chef, so the emblem was him, big mustache, and tall white hat. Anyway, I was hired there for like a summer job. And it ends up that the entire team left, and the only two people left were the chef, Hervé, his dog, and myself. Now, we liked to smoke pot a lot in those days. So we spent 3 months working in this place, 7 days a week, 18 hours a day. Getting paid a bit of overtime. Honestly, never had as much money in my life because they did pay. And it, for some strange reason, just fell in love with the whole atmosphere of the place.
Mm.
That not just that place, but the camaraderie that goes with the industry, the service, the rush, the downtime at the end, the whole industry itself.
Mm.
So life went on and things happened here and there. And I decided at one point that what I was going to do. I was going to do it. I was going to try and do it with the best people I could possibly do it. So I pulled out a book after having read many and said, all right, these are the top 10 dudes that I need to go and work for in order to in order to learn as much as I can possibly learn. So I sent 10 letters out to the 10 top chefs at the time. This is in France. And I got a lot of responses back, probably for the same reasons you would today, that they can't find any staff. So anyone that's sort of willing to come and work for them, they're happy to take them on board. But anyway, I got lots of responses. And I decided to go and work for Aranjuez. And that's where it kind of all, like in the serious part, really started. It was a long few years before that, but that really is where it started. And and that, you know, took its years and drove me to New York, a place where I'd grown up and was passionately wanting to return to. At this time, I had a child already, so he was about 2 when I first went to New York. Anyway, it all happened. It's kind of like that. And then you kind of get in, you realize that you're not too bad at it, and I was very ambitious. So arriving in New York, started in a top level in a big, big restaurant called the Russian Tea Room. It's a very famous place. I was there for a year and then was offered to open a place. I went to do that. I was very young. I was 24 or 25. So I did the opening. I obviously wasn't ready for that yet. It was a disaster. And then I went back to working for somebody else, Terrence Brennan. I spent 3 years at Pichelet.
Plus, if I remember that, is that the opening that it was a special day on that opening?
Yeah, the opening of that restaurant was on September 11th, 2001. So obviously we didn't open. We didn't open on that day. I remember yelling down the phone at my fish supplier because I was waiting for a huge piece of tuna for one of the canapés that we were preparing for this FHM magazine opening party for the opening of the restaurant called Opia, which it's still open. It's still there, 57th and Lex, if you want to pop by on top of the Kenneth Cole store. I'm doing promotional work. We're waiting for that. I was yelling at the guy, where the fuck is my tuna? And he's like, I don't know, dude, but there's something going on. But all the drivers are saying that they're blocked in traffic, and because obviously all the fish places are outside of the city. Fulton's Fish Market was the only one at the time. It was still open at the time, but we were getting fish out of Jersey and elsewhere. And he said, I don't know, something's going on. You know, nothing's moving. Traffic's not moving. They've closed down the bridges, closed down the tunnels. So I go storming upstairs, yelling at the guys in the dining room and the owners and saying, this is bullshit. I can't get fish, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, obviously look at the screens and everyone's huddled around and something's going on. So we went up to the top floor of the building, looking downtown. And, you know, then you saw what you saw. We're all familiar with the rest of the story. We ended up opening on the 13th. People really wanted a drink together in those days. So, and then the career went on, and I ended up working at Pichelin, which is a wonderful, wonderful fine dining restaurant. So back to the roots of gastronomy, which is where I started, and what I loved to do. I mean, I love the refinement and the putting of together of dishes and the thought process that goes behind, the thought process that goes behind putting a dish like that together, the ingredients and the seasonality and the use of a palate and your nose and your senses and all of that that goes into that creative process, more so than the business aspect, as we touched on earlier. And it's still a business, right? So all of those things need to come together and still make money. Otherwise, it doesn't work. But Terrence was a fabulous guy, and he gave me free rein on the kitchen. Did a lot of great work there. And it led to the meeting with Marlon Abella, who's a fabulous gourmet businessman. And he became a regular guest at Pichelin. He lives in London. He would fly into New York specifically to eat. And we got to know each other, well. He would call from London on a flight prior to taking a flight to New York and say, Bjorn, I'm coming, table of 6. I'm going to drink XXXX wine. Can you pair a meal? And we would have that kind of relationship, and I found it fabulous. Until one day he called me out from the kitchen and said, you know, basically, would you come and work for me? And I had been a Pichelin for 3 years almost, or 3 years just over. And I said, yes, let's do it. So we went and basically I was hired by him. We opened the first place in the States called Gaia in Greenwich, Connecticut. A very bizarre place, but it's where I met my wife. So I'm very grateful for that. Yeah, and then shortly after that successful opening, he invited me to come to London to reopen the greenhouse. So I did that. Greenhouse was an iconic restaurant. Gary Rhodes worked there for many years.
Yeah. You got your first Michelin star there.
Gary Rhodes got his first Michelin star there. I got my first Michelin star there. Yeah, so that was that road, and spent a couple of years. I got a rising star at the greenhouse, did some fabulous work, and then got a call from Gordon Ramsay, who said, "Hey, you know, I heard you're not happy," which wasn't the case. I just wasn't ever happy. Anyway, that was just me. It was miserable, always. So I said yes to Gordon. We had a meeting, and he had a space, and we went into business together in a partnership with him and his father-in-law, and ran a business called La Noisette for a year and a half. Got a star in the first within the first 6 months, which happens, of course. Nothing super rare, but an achievement nonetheless. And then we closed it down after a year and a half because it was just too expensive to run. And then my wife and I opened our own place in East London. Bit of an adventure in those days. It was still uncharted territory of sorts. And we ran that from start to finish almost 2 years. And then shut it down. Actually, just over 2 years altogether. Shut it down at the end of 2010. We sold it. And we moved to Asia. Got into hotels. And I learned about sustainability in a big way. I started with Six Senses and Sonoship Dasani and his wife, Eva. We were living in the Maldives and spent a lot of time in Sri Lanka and then in Bali. And got super involved with sustainable development, sustainable agriculture, permaculture, and started becoming quite passionate about the relationship that those subjects had to food and to how I saw the future, and what was really what I was attached to, and sort of things started taking shape and meaning. And all of a sudden, after 35, 38 odd years, I started realizing that, kind of started realizing what I really wanted in life. Ended up coming back to London, reopening Rosewood, meeting Omar for the second time, and realizing that what I really needed to pursue was this passion I had for sustainable development. However, that was going to be and take shape, and slowly, Slow Group came together, became something, and within that. Hopefully we'll get to the objective.
So how do you, so you started Slow Group together. That's the business you have together. How do you describe and talk about it?
We have three.
You have three businesses together.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So how does it work from an umbrella perspective, and how do you talk about the different projects or businesses that you have?
Well, we keep them separated, but I think we, like, through our experience, I mean, we've both been running different outlets at the same time, which is challenging, but you learn how to do it.
Okay.
So this is just the same thing. We see it as the same thing. We divide our time. We like to work. We work hard. We work long hours. We're chefs. That's what chefs do. We just try to divide our time, and whatever we have to share, we share it, and whatever we can take responsibility, we do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how we give results.
Right.
So we have we have Slow Group, which is we want to create a new restaurant group with just proposing new ideas, proposing new methods, not only through our, as Bjorn said, we like sustainability, and not through our food wastage and the food cycle, and using environmentally friendly products and producers and suppliers, and try to use sustainable fish. and all that products, but also through the management of the people. I think that's also, that also need to be sustainable, the way we are managing people. And as Bjorn said, like, even in those days, people is saying that there's no people working in the industry anymore, but it has never been. It's just, and I think that we want to make a difference in how to change it by doing some different proposals and some new ideas. And because we lived it, we are not just like another restaurateur that probably has money and just retired and then just open a restaurant, because that's what a lot of them do. We lived it. We worked there. We were just in front of that. So we know and we perceive how our team feels. So not just through overworking or not just, but also to a good environment and to provide them a nice environment where they can learn and where they can grow. I think one of my best achievements is just preparing chefs. When I always had my team, I always said I want to work with chefs, not just a laborer. You need to love your trade and you need to grow in your trade, even if you stay as a chef de party or your life, because you probably don't like responsibility, but just do it the best you can and just provide them with the tools that will allow them to do that. And if you want to go further, then even better.
Cool.
I just realized that it sounded like New York. We're on the 24th floor, but that siren there sounds like New York City. It's amazing how close it sounds. Yeah. Yet so far away.
So you have one of your main projects in crowdfunding. By the time this is going to be published, I believe the crowdfunding campaign will have started.
Let's
yeah, fingers crossed.
Let's fucking hope so.
So do you want to tell us about the project?
Yeah. So I think what you're talking about is bone tea.
I believe so, yes.
Bone tea. Rethink your drink. That's a trademark. Don't cough that. It is. Okay. Bone tea came. Okay, so how do I say this in like super? I'm going to be blunt, right, and super honest.
Okay.
In order to achieve the in order to achieve some of the goals that we have, there needs to be some kind of backing, financing. So there's two ways we can go about that. There is funding for our sustainable objectives, which is a way of going about it, because there are people out there that have money scratching their head what to do with it, or for us to develop a business that makes money and then the money is ours and we can choose to do with it what we want and not necessarily, you know, with somebody else as another boss. So we, beyond wanting to open restaurants and develop concepts and train people, etc., which we do under the umbrella of Slow Group, we were also looking for a concept, a product that could be lucrative, something that we could design, develop with our skills and our knowledge and our technical abilities, and place on the high street and build as a brand, something that would have some kind of sellability, if you will, in a short term. And so, you know, we looked at what are these successful brands that have been able to do this in a fairly short period of time. Chilango, or what's the other type of place that's done very, very well?
Tortilla?
Chipotle.
You know, some ice cream brands. Ben & Jerry's a good example. Started out of, you know, that kind of thing. Starbucks, yeah. Whatever. High Street. So we started thinking about, that's the kind of model, right? Then we thought, okay, what's going on in the market? What are people doing? So one thing that we realized was that there's this sort of huge, and it doesn't stop, it keeps growing and growing and growing. People walking around with a damn paper cup in their hand. Mm. Now, you know, if you look at certain times of the day in certain big transport areas, big train stations, etc., the queues outside of the Starbucks of this world, Costa Coffee, Cafe Nero, these are brands here. I'm sure there's many others all over the world that we know of, Dunkin' Donuts, et cetera, Krispy Kreme, buying coffee in paper cups. What is that? There was some decision that was made by society that this is the new way to go. Because 20 years ago, in Europe at least, there was, you know, it, people would look at you funny if you said, yeah, in 20 years we'll be walking around with a paper cup full of venti creamed latte and double shot caramel coffee stuff, right? Even though in New York it was probably already happening a little bit, maybe not to that extent with different varieties, but going to a deli and picking up a coffee was a normal thing.
Mm.
But not here. So I thought, okay, there's this paper cup thing. Then there's the grab and go, because people don't have time to sit down and have lunch or sit down and have breakfast or have breakfast at home before leaving, etc. So no one has time, so especially in a big city. So they're grabbing things. And the grab and go prepared food market is forever growing and doesn't plan to be stopping anytime soon. I'm not going to give out figures because it's boring, but that's the case. You can do the research. So we looked at that and we saw all these elements coming together. We thought, okay, we know how to do that. We can develop some prepared food that we know how to do very well, you know, with our experience. And what's missing in the paper cup? What other alternative can we put in there that's going to satisfy this fashion, if you will, of walking around the paper cup, that soothing hot drink, but that's not coffee, that has a sustainable aspect to it, that has an organic aspect to it, that has a local aspect to it. These terms that we're close to that mean something for us. And we started doing the research on what, and all of a sudden we saw that there was this little sort of budgeting germ of a trend happening in the broth movement, the paleo diet variety of people, health, lifestyle, fashion, still a very niche market, but it was we had a feeling that, hey, something's happening there. Something's going on.
And I would say, like, on one hand, that whole trend, but on another hand, there's like the many markets where people are just, it's a very old tradition to do that. Like, yeah, you know, we're used to it in Singapore. Yeah, and
we know yeah. that in Asia, you have a Bakuta's breakfast. And, yeah. and not only in Asia, but I mean, in America, every lunch in Mexico, you started with a caldo.
Yeah.
That's something that also happened in Spain. In the tapas bars, you just have the dream broth, which is the caldo de sueños.
Yes.
Which you just had at the end of your meal, just before going to sleep, after your tapas session. So we realized, well, we're in a metropolis, and we're just so globalized that people from different places living here. What's the thing that could appeal to everybody? And then, yeah, there you go, it's broth too. Mm. So, through all the points that Bjorn touched, and then, just seeing this little movement moving around, and as Bjorn said, very different groups of people, for very different benefits, if you call it, or interests. Mm. We just said, why don't make it? What's the difference between what did actually make Starbucks successful? How did it change the culture in Paris, even, which is, I believe, or Italy, where the coffee was the strongest culture in the whole world? How do they swap to a paper cup? Well, because it's a lifestyle. Because what you're selling them, it's an idea, mm-hmm. and it's a lifestyle. So if we're going to send them a lifestyle, then, and a lot of people's worried about their current lifestyle and how to improve it, how to make it healthier, more sustainable, better, in a lot of ways. Well, why don't we offer a lifestyle brand that offers that to your busy schedule?
Mm.
So that's what we said. Well, that's I think Bounty fits all that.
Mm.
So it also relates very much to what all fashion or architecture or any kind of trade and craft really is, this thing that keeps coming up, and in your industry, the future.
Looking
future
for the
past.
New thing.
Futures in the past. Futures.
Absolutely. And then I was at a talk with a futurist again. And every time I hear a futurist, they like talk about like looking to the past or the future. I mean,
because we don't know anything
do.
Else.
No, because actually the future hasn't happened.
Yeah, exactly.
It's one of the fabulous things about it.
You can only invent the future based on what you know.
Yeah.
Right. So what we do know is that we know how to make broth. We've been doing it for a long time. So that's where we are.
Yeah. And so one thing, because I know a lot of people, and I've heard like vegetarians or people like that, talk about the fact that raising animals is not particularly sustainable because you need a huge amount of and the broth is made mostly from animals, but what makes it sustainable?
Well, what makes it sustainable is the bones. I think we are in a culture that it's super hedonistic, and you just, like, we change all our habits. Before, we used to kill the whole animal and eat offal, and still you can see it in countries in development, they still eat offal. Mm. But in first world countries, no, we stop it. It's just chicken breast. It's just lean meat. Mm. It's just all that. And what you do with the whole rest of the animal. And yes, that's when it's not sustainable. Yeah, that's when it's not sustainable because, yeah, or go to that way of eating chicken nuggets or the slimy dog to make burgers. Well, that is not sustainable either. So what will help will be first understanding the amount of meat that you're eating, mm. but also if you're killing an animal, use it all.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's how we are gonna make bread sustainable, because we're gonna use all the discarded parts of the animal that sometimes by ignorance you don't use, mm. but they are still like super full of flavor and protein and the whole thing. So that's what we are gonna do with Bounty. That's what we're doing with Bounty and in our broth bars. Not only by selling broth, but by selling some other products that are part of that. We develop our buns, which are made of bull meat, used by some cuts that are super tasty. That some of them are chef secrets. That if you just braise them slowly, you just have the best meat. And then again, attacking another trend, which is pull meat, which I don't know. I mean, that's very normal in my country, but suddenly in Europe, it just became a big trend. But that's good. It's just tasty meat coming from some parts that you don't expect them. Mm. So that's how the buns were born, because the broth is, our broth is not only made with buns, but also with those cuts. Mm-hmm. And by using organic vegetables and try not to add, like, we don't add salt, we don't add any extras. It's just the main flavor. I mean, that's what is good. It's the same again. Go back to basics, go back to the past. And then before, we don't have all those additives.
Yeah.
So just go looking for the answers in the past, as you said. Yeah.
And you're going to have, is it five main types of broth?
Five main ones published. And then we've got an open gap for a seasonal broth.
Oh, really? So five main, which are?
Beef, chicken, pork, mushroom, and fruit, stone fruit.
Interesting. Yeah. And plus there will be a seasonal broth.
Turkey for Christmas.
Okay.
You know, rabbit for Easter. You know, game during the fall game season. Maybe a lamb and
but even going through some others like floral in summer, because we cannot sell, or it's hard to eat broth cold because it just solidifies. So it's just flowers. We are not using enough flowers. Use the flowers to just do chamomile is awesome. Hibiscus is awesome.
Yeah.
All that kind of flavors, just put them to a broth, to a hot drink. Brilliant. Or a cold drink. So, yeah.
Brilliant. Cool. Is that all you wanted to say?
Just one last thing on the sustainable thing. We're obviously using the entire animal, but also we're very careful where the product's coming from. Mm. So we're sourcing our meat, be it the beef, the chicken, or the pork, or what have you, from sustainable farming sources, organic agriculture, biodynamic agriculture, and really promoting the idea that eat meat, nothing wrong with it, it's a good thing, but eat it responsibly and eat less of it, but eat better. That's the idea, rather than mass chicken farming. Eat one chicken every couple of weeks, but make sure it's a good one and make it last.
I think another good thing will be to understand where it came from. I mean, nowadays all the kids they just go to the supermarket and just pick up a package.
Yeah.
They don't even really know where chicken comes from. They don't even associate it with a live animal.
Yeah.
So that's another thing. Just
maybe we should start killing chickens at home.
Give them an understanding that where it comes from and that it's an animal and it's another entity that you are eating and it's okay. Yeah. We've been doing it for years, but just be aware of that.
Yeah.
That's all.
Deserves respect.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you. So I remember Bjorn, you saying several times that the kitchen's your playground, and there's been obviously, I mean, a lot of cooking shows, right? And cooking and chefing is taking this whole important that seems very, very serious. and slightly less associated with the idea of playing in the kitchen.
Yeah.
What do you think of that? I mean, do you have any advice for anybody to how to play in the kitchen rather than take it so seriously, perhaps, over their dinner event? I don't know. Or is it good that they're taken seriously?
I think some programs take it super seriously. I think other programs have fun and play.
Yeah.
Even play on the fact that they are taking it seriously, so they're not taking themselves too seriously, if you know what I mean. Mm. Seriously. Yeah, it's got to be a playground at the time when it's appropriate to play. And then curtains open. Mm. And then you're on show. So there's a moment of performance there that needs discipline and an amount of seriousness in order to perform, because at the end of the day you are producing a product for a customer that is paying often a lot of money in a very serious kitchen, a lot of money in anyway, and they're putting it in their mouths and they're putting it in their bodies, so it's serious stuff. It's not but there's an element prior to that, the preparation time and all of that, which is a playful, creative time. And I think there needs to be, and again, this is personal, but I believe there needs to be a good balance between that playful playground aspect and the discipline and seriousness of open curtain performance. Mm.
Cool.
But yeah, as far as the TV goes, well, you know, hey, people must love watching it because there's more and more of these shows available or on. So, and some of them are great, and some of them are terrible. Chefs are not necessarily born actors, are they? So I think some of them should just be better off away from the camera.
Cool. So I usually finish these interviews with the cool down questions.
Okay.
So it's the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. So do you like ice cream?
I love ice cream. There's nothing better than it, like vanilla, homemade vanilla ice cream.
Homemade vanilla. I was going to ask you for your favorite flavor.
That's one of them. But actually, one of my favorite, or probably my favorite, it's one that we make in Mexico called the Kiss of an Angel, which it has mamey fruit, which is, it's just unique from Central America, like all down Mexico to Central America. That's, it's kind of a jungle thing. It's, mamey, it's pink, it's beautiful, it's creamy, and through that textures we add, it's very from our conquistador times, where it was the fusion of ethnic food with Spanish food. So it's an ice cream that has pine nuts and almonds, but also with the mamey fruit, and it's awesome. It's called Kiss of an Angel, and it has just a hint of cherries too. Mm. And it's beautiful. I mean, that's one of my best ones.
What do you make it, tell you, what does it look like, or what does it taste like?
Well, it tastes,
what do you, is there anything you can compare it to for anybody who doesn't know?
Well, it's kind of a much better amaretto meets strawberry ice cream kind of thing. I mean, okay. Mamey fruit is super smooth, and it's, I mean, it's kind of like a guava. It just has a unique flavor. I mean, that's one of my favorite ones. And I have also savory ice cream, which is not really an ice cream. It's a sorbet. But in Mexico, we used to mix everything with lime and chili. So mango and chili sorbet is actually one of my favorites.
Cool. Bjorn?
There you have it, folks. You got to go to Central America and
try the mamey fruit.
Yeah, I'm intrigued now as well.
Mm-hmm. I've not tried that either. I'm definitely intrigued.
I'm going to be really trashy. I've been thinking about this ever since Omar started talking. And although I used to love going to Swenson's, which is like an American ice cream parlor chain as a kid, because they had like bubble gum ice cream and, you know, all these crazy flavors, I really like Mr. Whippy's. Like soft frozen cream.
But the one from the truck here, like,
yeah, the one from the machine, yeah, real.
Because the machine, because natural. I've had some machine ones, like in Singapore, for example, of you know the Japanese branded with the milk from Hokkaido and the vanilla from wherever. So there's different. I mean, it depends on the ingredients you put in the machine, right?
Yeah, I guess it just depends. Absolutely, you know. But I just have it's that texture of frozen cream, I guess. Mm. that I that's straight from that you know, you pull the lever down and you get that.
Do you like it with the flake? In London, they
I'm
have
not a fan of the flake because I find it kind of dry.
Yeah,
I just like the ice cream.
Yeah, but if you come to London, don't be fooled because it's still called 99 and it's not anymore 99 since years ago. So just don't be fooled.
Yeah, it's always more than a pound. Everything's more than a pound. But it sounds weird, but I really like that texture.
Another question for the gamer. So I was talking about this with a game designer that I interviewed recently and talking about setting an atmosphere around a gaming table for tabletop games. So for example, a storytelling game where you're playing samurai in ancient Japan and pairing it with having, well, sushi for dinner. Hmm. So what's your favorite kind of story, like as a movie or whatever, and what would you cook for it?
Ah.
So let's say if you pick a genre, so science fiction or mystery or thriller or like, and if you pair like a style with a type of food.
Oh, interesting.
Well,
I can choose the genre if you're stuck because it's a big one.
I was actually talking with Bjorn about this before. As I mentioned, I love history. So yeah. Anything like related to Elizabethan and Tudor times, I love it. And then I love the way they did this as a theater, as a show. So they have this thing called cockatrice, uh-huh. which it was a pig sewed with a chicken's head or any other animal's head. And that was some of the features that they have. But not only that, they have pies where you cut through and it was rabbits coming out, doves, frogs, and it was a not like never ending meal for like 8 hours, which is, it's probably not sustainable anymore, of course. And it's not something that we'll probably look forward to do nowadays, but I will, on those times, I would have loved to feature it. And that all those like films from that times, it just reminds me that.
So multiple types of roasted animals.
Multiple types of roasted animals. Suiting together. Yeah,
like
just a bit Frankenstein.
Like
yeah, exactly. Like bear within a bear within a bear, that it's 12 birds in that. And that's where all these crazy ideas were born. So those times would have been fun to cook at. And
cool.
Under that, you know, that environment.
Yeah.
All the dresses and the whole thing. So, yeah.
Nice. Jury?
Manga dressed Mexican chef cooking coquetry food with feathers in it. I love it. God, it's a really tough question. I what really comes to mind is poetry. Why poetry? And of course, there's a whole array of genres of poetry. But I like to believe that menus should read like a poem,
mm-hmm.
and they should tell a story. And I've always enjoyed the menu writing process and that creative moment where you structure the menu. You obviously have some kind of background information as to how you're structuring it, right? It's the season and what's available on the market or what's available in the ground or blah, blah, blah. What's the context, et cetera. What's the environment? But then the menu should be written and read like a poem, in my opinion. And then from there, the process starts and the pieces start coming together. So the way I proceed is read it like a poem, put the words in place of each dish, and then start taking those ingredients, which are the words, and putting them together in the playground, which is the kitchen, and testing them, almost as if you're tasting it prior to actually making the dish, and then putting those tastes together in the kitchen in a combination or quantities that match in order for it to make something spectacular.
Wow.
So that's the process I go through. But that's how I envision this relationship of genre to food.
But it's funny because the place we are at, it just came from a Blade Runner idea that we had, and sharing a Blade Runner image.
I was just going to talk about
So I mean, I think film is intricate to our culture now, and I think as food, it offers all your sensations, it triggers a lot of your sensations, and I mean, even food is even more because you can taste it, but it's very visual too. It's just being in a restaurant. And as Bjorn said, it's like a show, and I had some friends filming me in the kitchen, and they believe that
what we do is very similar to what a director does. So you have your director and nobody talks when he's talking and he directs the whole scene. And then you have a producer, which is the guy that helps and then make sure everything is in place and all that. And then you have different elements from each one specialized on each thing that creates a whole movie. And that's pretty much how a kitchen and a restaurant work. You only have your manager or your chef, then your assistant, and then it goes the way down. So, and every element is important, as in film.
Yeah.
So I think it's very related to what we do.
Great. Last question. So I work in marketing and advertising. And is there an advert that comes to mind as like one that you refer to, that you remember, or that you really like?
Well, I just remember the Cadbury advert from with the gorilla. And I just remember it because a friend was like enjoying a lot some 90s music. Not a couple of days ago, and she was actually like playing the drums, and it just reminded me, like it just immediately reminded me that advertising of that Cadbury gorilla just playing the drums.
Big iconic ad, like very celebrated. Bjorn?
I don't know, the only ones that I can think memorable is that Old Spice, campaign that went on.
Yeah,
because it kind of it was just so ludicrous.
Mm.
So to me that was memorable in the sense of bringing I'm surprised they didn't go into this sexual scene with oh you smell like daddy kind of thing to bring that whole Old Spice thing back, because it is what it is, but that's all I can remember really off the top of my head.
Great.
As far as ad campaigns.
Cool. Anything else you want to add to finish this off, or anything you wanted to promote or talk about?
Well, by the time we are in Creighton, just check out Crowdcube and check out Bounty. And by the time we're there,
I'll add the links to Bounty. Are you guys also elsewhere online?
Yeah, we are. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. Twitter? Yeah.
On Facebook
Bounty
as well.
On Twitter, Bounty on Facebook, Bounty on Instagram, Bounty our website,
and keep updated with our projects. We're going to Mexico City soon. I'm going to show him what's May fruit and all about eating insects, which is part of my culture. So Bjorn is very keen to learn that. And so we're going down to Mexico City to the World Forum of Mexican Gastronomy. But check us out in Twitter. We both have Twitter accounts and
yeah. And I'll add all the links
and Instagram in the show accounts notes and when all I publish. That. Yeah.
Eat insects and remember the name Kojawan, and remember Bounty, and up and coming soon in East London, Naughty Yum Yums. So look out for that.
Cool. Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time, Bjorn and Omar. It's been really, really fun. And I'll see you soon. All right.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Well, there you go. Already another episode of the Burgeoning Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. All done. Don't worry, new episodes are on the way. They're going to be coming out soon enough, just in another 10 days or so. If you've enjoyed listening, of course, I hope you did. All I want is really for more people to be listening to this. So if you have a friend you think might enjoy it, just send it on to them. If ever you have any questions, if you have ideas for people that you'd like me to interview for the podcast, just send over a message. If you have any questions about your marketing or branding strategy, communications, please keep in touch as well. I'm always happy to help, either via the contact form on the main website. That's www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Icecreamforeveryone.net. You can send me a tweet. And of course, follow me on Twitter as well. My handle is @HippoWill. And there's a Facebook page. The Ice Cream for Everyone is on Facebook as well. So you can click the like button there to get regular updates. Of course, there's also the Ice Cream Sunday newsletter, the email newsletter you can sign up to from the website or on Facebook, or, I mean, there's many different links in different places. I write and send a new story every week, usually based on personal experiences or whatever I'm inspired by, every week. Thanks again for listening. Really, really appreciate your time, and hopefully see you next time. Bye-bye.